Okay, let's not start with a trivia question. We'll come to the trivia question when we get to do some work, and when you start, you know, fading off, and I'll use trivia question to wake you up. Okay. Well, as I said, this is the last lecture, but this is really the beginning of like even more chapters, as you can see, that a yellow book I covered about this much. Okay, let's recap. What we learned is that we want to study a cylinder for some string theory motivated reason. And the cylinder can be mapped to a complex plane, constant time, gets to map to constant radius, the path infinity gets to map to the origin. And we also look at the two-point correlated function, and it's completely determined up to some constant we can choose as the normalization, so it's completely determined. And yesterday we derived the celebrated Virasoro algebra. So now our road is clear. We have an algebra. The next things to do is to find the representations. And then you will see the possible particles will be all form some representation of this algebra, then we're done. So today's outline, let's see. It's in two folds. So first part, we'll talk about the Hilbert space of our conformal field theory, that we have no idea what the conformal field theory is. Maybe at the end of the day, we will have some idea. After all, I promise that eventually we have to answer the question we'll ask the first day, what theories? But let's say Hilbert space, we have built this before, and then the first thing we do, let's define something called asymptotic states. Then there should be something going out, assuming that we can do some measurement about them. And then we should talk about the property of the vacuum. And after this is settled, then we can actually to find the primary state, which corresponds to the primary operator, which happens to be our highest weight state. I hope you still remember the terminology of highest weight. And then we'll start to build the reps of the Virasoro algebra. And then, okay, I can't spell descendant, so let me still call them the children's state. I promised them we're going to talk about them, so today we're going to build them. And we'll also talk about the children operators. And then also, I promise there's a miracle is going to happen. Miracle number one is that all correlation functions can be done if we know all correlation function of the primaries. And the second part, we're going to see what unitarity will tell us. So what's unitarity? Unitarity really says you have some state which I haven't built, so I can't write anything in the middle. But I always demand the norm, norm square should be bigger or equal to zero. That's basically what unitarity says. And we'll do this first with level one. We'll define this level one later. And then we'll do it for some very special state. And then we'll do it for level two. And then guess what? We'll assume that, you know, from three to infinity is done by somebody. And I will like tell you the result. The result is something called a minimal models. Now, unitarity minimal models. And these are that's the what series part. And this is our miracle number two, that indeed there are some of the conformal field theories are so constrained, we only have finite number of primary fields. So with this to miracle, we happily says, oh, we solved the theory. Let's move on. Okay, so I guess let's start the Hilbert space. So first, let's start a very, very, very important concept in conformal field theory, which is only possible in conformal field theory. It's called the state operator correspondence. You might have heard about them. It says that for any state in this Hilbert space, it's always corresponding to some local operator. I guess they just sort of try to make the name shorter, but it's really local. But if you think about this, this is crazy. Let's think about a QFT. What you learn from QFT is local operator is something depends on a specific location. That's called a local operators. And then what is a state? A state is a wave function. And this wave function depends on some field configuration, on some spatial slice. And then you say if you take some, then this wave function, you take the mod square, you will find the probability such specific field configuration will have. And how could they ever be related with this correspondence? This depends on a whole spatial slice. This depends on a local operator in sets depends on one point. Oh, this is crazy. But it's not crazy if we have this powerful symmetry managed to map a cylinder to a complex plane. Because in this case, there is a case that there is spatial slice is mapped to a single point. And that's why this works in CFT. It doesn't work on QFT. This is really the moral of the story because I am able to find, for example, find a state and do the path integral all the way back to infinity, map over here, find a local operator. So this is possible. In fact, we're going to use this to define our in state, the state that in the asymptotic past, the asymptotic past, and past, the infinite past, for conformal field theory means origin. So this is defined to be, let me put a local operator, and acting on the vacuum, and then take the limit that will go to origin. So this is a state. So this is what we mean by state operator correspondence, is you can always act your local operator, act on the vacuum at the origin, and that will create us a state. Okay, so check mark, in is done. Let's do out state. Well, I can really define the out state very quickly. I'm gonna define my out state to be the complex conjugate of the instinct. And you were like, hey, you didn't do anything because you didn't tell me what do you mean by the Hermitian conjugate. So it means that if we want the out state, we need to define what it does Hermitian conjugate mean. Specifically, what does Hermitian conjugate mean if it acts on a primary field, since that's all we care. Okay, so let me make a proposal first. I propose that the phi dagger at the ZZ bar, okay, sorry, back up. Before I make the proposal, I have to make a comment. Because Hermitian conjugate in QFD says it do things, but it doesn't change your space-time. T is still T, X is still X. And this is the problem we decide from day two that we're living in Euclidean. In Euclidean, our X naught is IT. If you still have want to have the property that doesn't change space-time, the Euclidean time will be mapped to minus X0. Which means we start with our Z. Hopefully you still remember from the tutorial, it's an exponential function. It will be mapped to e to the minus x0 plus I x1, e to the x0 minus I x1, 1. And this is z star, 1. So z under Hermitian conjugate will be mapped to 1 over z star. So now I can make my proposal. My proposal is the phi dagger is equals to phi 1 over z bar, 1 over z, and then with some factors. And now I'm going to propose this factor is 1 over z bar to 2h, and then 1 over z to 2h bar. Pay attention to the bar location. That's why in the first time in my life, I'm not as lazy as before that I actually write the bar part. Because the Hermitian conjugate switch the z and z bar and inverse them. So the bars are related this way. OK, I guess I have motivation to write the part. Now let me motivate to you about this factor. So, well, there are actually two motivations about why this should be the Hermitian conjugate. For example, the first thing I want to do is now I have an asymptotic state in and out. You know, one good property is that one good property is if I calculate the correlation, the inner product of state, but since state operator has correspondence, so I will be slightly sloppy when I say inner product, that probably also means the correlation function. But I want to calculate this inner product and I want it to be well defined. For example, finite would be, you know, a nice property. Otherwise, we need to use the dark magic of renormalization, which is the motivation to study CFTs. We try to not get to them. OK, so let's just plug this guy out. Yeah, plug this in says that we need to take everything goes to 0 eventually, and the out state is this proposed thing. And then the in state is that guy. Okay. Ah. Okay.
Huh? Why do you have W in the limit?
Haha, very good point. Excellent point. In principle, the in state and out state should take different limits. But let's be sloppy. And it says we already take the W limit and just put this at a 0, 0. I can't quite be sloppy with this guy, otherwise I have to write infinity, infinity. So, but let's try to say, why don't I define a new variable, which is just 1 over z, which now you shouldn't be surprised, because the inverse conformal symmetry has been used quite a lot in this class. Then I can just write this as cosi bar and the cosi, and this become cosi bar 2h, cosi 2h bar. And now I'm taking cosi bar to infinity. Uh-huh. But this we know how to calculate. Look, This is called the correlation function of a two primary field. The result is right over there. So it tells us the result should be psi bar to the 2H. Since we have the same state, the B psi to the 2H bar, with some constant, let's call it a D, whatever. Now the good thing is, see, there are divergence here coming from the definition of the proposed proportional thing in the phi dagger. And then there's divergence coming. Then there's some very nicely behaved thing coming from the correlation function such that the divergence cancel. We're just left with this constant, which make our inner product well defined. So that's why we proposed exactly that factor in front of the phi 1 over z bar 1 over z thing. It's a good thing to do. It's a very thin thing to do to require our inner product is finite. Okay? So let's do another thing. Try harder to say that this is really, really a thin thing to do. So let's do mode expansion, as we have done quite a few times. And then you realize there is this, okay. First of all, now I have proposed this thing, I decide to go back to my sloppy me, and now we only consider chiral. Chiral quasi-primary. Now we have a great idea where the ZZ bar, where does the bar go. We'll come back to only chiral field and claim that it admits a mode expansion like this. And you realize, remember yesterday we have something like this. And remember the T conformal weight is 2. Yeah, so that's a lovely guess. And hopefully, you know, it will make our things look simpler later. So we propose for any quasi-primary field, we should just expand with Z. The exponent has explicitly the conformal weight there. Okay, so what do we do now? What we do now is we wonder what's the mode expansion of phi dagger Z. Well, by definition, it's equals to phi dagger Z bar, this thing. You just dagger it. But on the other hand, I know phi dagger Z is equals to that thing, which is 1 over Z bar to the 2H, phi at 1 over z bar. Okay, let me write the n explicitly instead of using the generalized Einstein convention. Okay, so but this guy, I know how to expand it. I expand it using the definition of the mode expansion, which gives me and I can continue, says, hey, these are all Z bars. I can certainly combine them. So this is Z bar to the n plus h minus 2h. So it's this guy. We're almost there. Now we are just saying, you are summing over all the integers. So if I send my n to minus n, there's nothing changes. And now we harvest the fruit, which is comparing the two mode expansion. One is by definition, and the other is through that definition. And then we make a very awesome observation. Okay, this color is not visible. You get phi n dagger is equals phi minus n. So that's a good thing. Otherwise, you have to remember a lot of things. But now that if you know the mode expansion of phi, you already know what's the mode expansion of phi dagger. They are simply related. precisely because we choose the good definition of Weidegger and we choose the mode expansion to including the conformal weight. In particular, we have LM dagger equals L minus M, which I reveal some secret that I haven't told you, is although TZ is not primary, it is a quasi-primary. This you could check the notes. What the notes does is look at the TTOPE, and according to the definition, the change of the field is equal to some commutator of the charge and the field, and figure out what's the infinitesimal transformation of this field, and then upgrade it to the finite transformation of that field, and then realize that the field actually transforms nicely if we only consider global symmetry. But anyway, the moral of the story is that this phi dagger, phi n dagger equals phi minus n thing works for T in particular. Okay, so we have one more thing to look at, the vacuum. So let's look at the vacuum and say what property it has. Well, T is related to energy. So what we do is say, well, TZ acting on vacuum, according to our argument, is going to create a state. And then this is related to energy. Let's demand this to be regular. It's not an insane thing to do. I like everything to be regular. Okay. And then we use the mode expansion. And then, of course, you see that Z has some interesting exponent such that make it not always regular. So when minus n minus 2 is smaller or equals to minus 1, we have a problem. And this can also be written as n bigger or equal to minus 1. So when n bigger or equals to n minus 1, we have a problem, is that there is going to be non-infinities there, so that we have to require this equals 0. So the vacuum cat is annihilated by all the Ln when n is bigger or equal to minus 1, such that our energy doesn't go insane. And similarly, precisely because after you dagger, you pick up a minus sign, we know that to annihilate the Bra vacuum, you demand that your n is smaller or equals to 1. So this x, this one. So then we conclude that minus 1, 0, 1, again, so important numbers in our life with the anti-holomorphic part, annihilate both vacuum, this zero and this R. Okay, so it's good to know that our vacuum is annihilated by these things that are corresponding to the global conformal transformation, which is good. We demand the conformal symmetry. Okay, so that's vacuum. Okay, we'll come to our first some calculation to be used. We'll do this calculation and we'll come to our first trivia question of the day. Okay, so what the calculation we want to do is say what's the commutator of this guy, which I will use later. But now you should be an expert at doing this, using the TZ, Z plus 1, this contour integral thing. Then you say, then it's just a matter of changing the contour. I can just write it as an operator product. and operate a product. I know the expansion. Expansion is partial phi with the simple pole, and the h phi with the double pole. Such things of life. And then I can just do the contour integral, says that this guy, you don't have to do anything because it's a simple pole. And the other guy, you do one derivative. Okay. What's interesting is that you realize if you're acting this one of this tensor Laurent mode LM at one of some of our generator on the primary field, it would produce some partial phi over here, which we'll learn this is the descendant. So this is, we already say one child state over here. Okay. So that completes our discussion to lay out the tools to build the reps. And so it's probably a good point to just, you know, clear our head off the messy calculation a little bit and answer a trivia question. So the trivia question is, what does taking Dan's QFT course have in common with going to play in a Quidditch game in Hogwarts? Hint is you have to know what's a Quidditch game and you have to have taken Dan's QFT class. Let me review the answer then. In both but I have to continue. Look, I have done here. I have to continue somehow. I have lots of things to do. Okay, how about, no, I can't let you think about the answer while I continue, then you have to be focused on the part. That definitely doesn't work. Okay, come on, let me review the answer. What's the most important thing in the Quidditch game? If you're playing it. Yes, the answer is you both need a broomstick. In one case, you need to fly, the other case, you want to sweep the infinities under the carpet. All right. I hope you're more alerted now, and we'll continue back to build what's the highest weight thing. All right. So our tools are done. We have some phi dagger defined, some infinite past, infinite future, and the vacuum studied, and there's a fun calculation over there. So yep.
Does that definition of L minus 1, L 0, 1 annihilating 0, is that the definition of the vacuum?
That's just that if you demand that the energy is doesn't blow up, that's just the result. The L minus 1, L 0, L 1 has to annihilate the vacuum. Whatever vacuum you found, it should have to be annihilated by those.
So you need to define the vacuum just as a class of states which could be vacuum.
Right, but you can ask the Dalimodalium claim that the vacuum in CFT is not degenerate. But you should ask him. I'll try to find him today too. But okay, so let's start building things. Where am I? Okay, remember we defined. We found a primary operator, we act on vacuum, we call it the asymptotic state. Now I decide to label this state by its conformal weight. It's just a label. Conformal weight is as good a label as any other label. Okay, let's label that way. And the question I want to ask is, what happens if I act L0 on it? It's a very useful question to ask. Remember L0 corresponding to something like a dilatation on the complex plane corresponding to time evolution, which means L0 is close related to the energy. So if you in quantum mechanics, you give me a state, I want to know what's the Hamiltonian act on it. So in conformal field theory, you give me a state, I want to know what's the L0 act on it. It's a very good question to ask. But let's use the definition. OK, I'm being sloppy again, only keep track half of the things, because I'm not smart enough to keep track of all things. And this is the usual trick. Whenever we do quantum mechanics, we say this thing, we use the commutator, and we swap them. And it's very well motivated, because zero is annihilated, which also tells us that our vacuum has zero energy, which is nice. Then this commutator, we're going to use that fun fact. I have an inconsistency between M and N's, but oh. OK, according to that commutator, since we decide to insert it at a zero, so the insert it at a zero, so W is zero, so first term doesn't matter. And the other term just gave me W to the zero, which is 1. 0 plus 1 is still 1. I like this kind of calculation. They are all 1s. So this gave me H5. And you get act back to 0, so this gave me H. Oh, isn't that nice? I decided to choose a random label that happens to be the energy. I'm proud of myself. All right. Well, the next thing, what do? We have other generators. I might as well acting on H, see what happens. Well, this is also what you do in quantum mechanics. I act some operator on a state, then I wonder again, what's the energy now, right? Things we wonder about life. Okay, so premises. And the first thing we know, we spend the whole class trying to figure out what's the first thing. The commutator should give us minus M, LM. And the other guy is the eigenstate. So H should come out. So this is awesome. This gave me H minus M, M, LM acting on H. Isn't that nice? I find the eigenstate, and I find some operator acting on it. It's still eigenstate with some different eigenvalues. OK, this is the energy. So I can always say I want the energy bounded from below. And this is certainly not going to be true. If I allow this to happen, it just energy just keep dropping. So now I'm going to make a physical requirement that says LM acting H annihilates H. Then when M is equal to 1. OK, at this point, I hope this reminds you of something. We have some highest weight state, and I act the things on it. It lowers the energy. If I act the minus ones, it raises the energy. Well, a long time ago, well, like 4 months, 3 months, I told you that OB1 is not our only hope. SU2 is. So let's see. It is. Look. Let's see the analogy between our Virasoro algebra, I call it the very joy algebra, compare it with our celebrity SU2, which we know so well about. So first analogy should be L0, because that gives me the eigenvalues. So this is the Cartan generator. Oh, using very mundane language, this is our J3. And now we have all these LMs. When M is bigger than 0, it annihilates the highest state, which means it must be the raising operator. It lowers the energy, but it's the raising operator, because it annihilates the highest state. So this corresponding to J plus. And the guys with M smaller than 0, which is the lowering operator, and this is the G minus. And our H, we find, is the highest weight state. This corresponding to the highest weight state. It's corresponding to spring G and M equals G as well. And then now we know what to do, exactly what to do. We just act a bunch of these guys. Just keep doing it. Acting on our highest weight state with our lowering operator. And this should correspond to building a representation with spin J and the other quantum number equals M. So this will furnish a representation of Rivera-Sauer algebra. So because we learned LSU too well, we already built a representation of Rivera-Sauer algebra. That's how you build it. You find the primary field, you insert the origin, create the primary C state, and then you just using all your lowering operator to acting on them. And this is what are the children state. That was quick. Now it's like. Yes?
We could have done the same thing for the width algebra, right?
What?
For the width algebra, we could have done the same thing. So I'm not really seeing how the central charge plays a role here. Because so far we also used the broomstick on this one, right?
Broomstick? Broomstick? The broomstick, the C will come into play in the second part. We're going to constrain it. Yeah, at this point, C doesn't come. C doesn't come into play because we don't have the n plus m equals zero case yet. True, it will be here. Huh? Oh wow, it's only 10 minutes. You get another trivia question. Good for you. I don't know how these trivia questions are so spaced such that you don't have to concentrate very long. Anyway, let me make one more comment about the last trivia question. See, the point is, when you're learning things from Dan says, let's sweep all the infinities under carpet. And then when you learn OPE from me, I said, let's sweep all the regular terms under the carpet. So if we're doing calculation together, we're like, oh, there's nothing to be done. They're all under the carpet. Okay, well, now this is really the nice time for this trivia question. It's even supposed to be here. So the question is, in early 90s, telephones are invented. And by then, you know, it's very complicated. You call to somebody, and there is somebody picking up the phone call and then call to the person you call. And these people are known as operators. The question is, how many operators does US, the country below us, have? That country is known as America. Well, I'm going to review the question soon, the answer soon, because we still need to move on. Come on. This is not a hard question. This is related to what we talked like. Yeah, because there are activities recovered. Thank you. Thank you. Actually, then we checked that the record is supposed to be like a 38 or something, because that's how many states the United States have when it's invented. Yeah, who cares? Who cares about those details, right? All right, I have to make a new trivia question for string theory now, because that's the one I borrowed from last year's string theory. But anyway, okay, so. By state operator correspondence, we're going to learn the descendant states. I mean, the operators. Let's call them the children operators. I mean, it makes sense. See, these are the children states, and you wonder what operators they correspond to. Oh, by the way, the answer is 50 because of state operator correspondence. You already got this bathroom break to figure it out. Anyway, let's learn about the children operators. So how do we, like, we already seen one of them here. It's basically related to some partial phi. But let's now, instead of in QFT, you just throw infinities under the carpet. Now let's recover these regular terms that I throw under carpet. We'll open that carpet and see what's underneath it. Okay, so let's try to define formally what descendants are. So as established yesterday, that the OPE of TZ and phi W is equals to partial phi over Z minus W and H phi over Z minus W square. Sorry, I'm bugged by this. Let me organize as the increasing order of the exponent. And we say if we only do OPE, we don't care about the regular terms. But let's recover them as dot, dot, dot. So now they are recovered as dot, dot, dot. And now we are going to define the children operator formally, which I told too many jokes and I forgot how to define it formally. But okay, we'll define this formally as an expansion with n bigger or equal to minus 2 and z minus w to the power n, and with some interesting funny hat operation acting on phi, which I call them these other children operators. So we claim all the children or grandchildren, or any, they are all children, of primary field.
Is phi the children operator or L acting on phi?
The children means like many layers, all levels of children. Like descendants. That word is hard for me. So this is really all the things that you can get out of a primary field. And we claim they are all captured if we didn't do OPE. Instead, we capture all the regular term as well. And this is a formal definition. It just says, yeah, you can always expand things in Lorentz series. And if it's a primary field, it starts with minus 2. So let's look at this and the map and see what we get is L0 acting on phi gave us H phi. Wait, did I lose exponent? Yes. That's very important. I'm just moving the numbers around. Okay. It's still the same summation, but I decide to call n a different n. Because this definition actually makes sense. In this definition, L0 acting on phi will pick up the H phi. So you still have sort of this L0 hat is also capturing the eigenvalue of the energy. So it makes sense. If you do zero level children, then you get the parent. You have no children yet. So the first level of children will be this guy. They say you have a primary field, you take the partial derivative, you get your first level of children. It makes sense. And you're like, what about all this dot, dot, dot? Well, for a general primary field, I have absolutely no idea. But, of course, if I don't give you an example, just like give you a formal distribution, you were like, I have still no clue about anything about the children's state. At least, okay, I know about the children's state, but I have no idea about the grandchildren. So at least we should state one example that has grandchildren involved. So in one particular case, I do know how to calculate the regular term. Is when the primary field I choose is identity. That gives me identity has conformal weight of zero. And the partial identity is still zero. So the regular term must be given by TZ itself. It makes sense. I say TZ times identity is equals 0 plus 0 plus TZ. Seems very thin. And this This tells that will allow us to read off this term, which scales the exponent of z minus w is 0, which tells us a fun fact that Tz, our fabled energy momentum chiral field, is actually the grandchildren of identity, which have conformal rate 2. So in this particular definition, you would say that the children operator, I'll state, which it's hard to keep track of, would have a conformal weight n plus h bar. So this guy will have conformal weight 1. And if you do 2 level, the grandchildren will have conformal weight 2. And then ask if you have experience, can you level up? No. The energy momentum tensor is always the level 2 descendant of identity. So that's some example of children operator. And now is the time to see the miracle after we define the children operator formally. Well, it's more like very hand-waving version of the miracle. I'll do something crazy. It's definitely crazy. Okay, any questions? Well, I'm trying to figure out how to move the board such that I can see the last one, but not caring about the middle one and erase this part. Okay, so now give me a primary field. I also know how to build this children operators. And they're just built by acting this L hat onto phi. So you could have level 0, which is the parent that has phi. The field is phi. And of course, the number of states is 1. And the conformal weight is h. And you have level 1 children. And then you get this L minus 1 hat acting on phi. You still have only one state. And you raise the energy by 1. And level 2, now you have more choices. You can add a level 2 on it. Or you can add 2 level 1 on it. And then you get two states, and get h plus 2. And level 3, you can do L minus 3 on it, also minus 1, minus 2 on it, L minus 1 to the cube on it. And you get h plus 3. And you can see that this thing grows very quickly. All this at the same energy, it's highly, highly degenerated. And there are people who are very good at accounting because it's just a partition of integers. And you can look at the formula in the notes. I'm not very enlightened by it, so I'm not going to write it down. But this is the case. You give me a primary field. You give me an energy momentum chiral field. I can build all the states. No, all the operators and all the states. So now let's look at this miracle. The miracle is basically says, let's again harvest the fruits from a complex plane. All crops, rather. But anyway, the point is, let's consider the following correlation function with a bunch of insertions. And let's take this counter to be really, 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 really big, such that all these things are enclosed in it. So here is the picture. It says somewhere over here I insert the operator, somewhere here I insert the operator, somewhere here I insert the operator. And I can see the contour very big, enclose all of them. I wonder what's the correlation function of that. remember, whenever we have a contour, we always like to deform them. So in particular, I can deform such that they become teeny circles around my inserted local operators. And then we can choose the cycles to be so teeny such that they are all well separated. So I know, so I can choose in such a way that this is already well radially ordered if you choose the contour nicely enough. Sort of. Okay, but if that's the case, then I can say this is the sum of these teeny contours from 1 to n. Then I can bring, when I choose the jth contour, I can just bring my dz, tz next to the phi j guy. Because now this is correctly radial ordered by the assumption of these, all these teeny contours are separated from each other. And now, then we come back to Nicholas' question yesterday, what do we mean by close? And this is what we want to use. And if we choose these teeny contours, then we claim these two are close together enough compared to the rest, such that we can use the powerful OPE to replace this part. So the OPE comes again, then you have to do a contour integral again, which we did multiple times. Then I can just write down the results. Is that each of them will contribute to something like this, which is very recognizable. And this, there is, now there exists a partial operator. But then I can take this out. And what's inside is just the prime free field correlation function. So this is known as the conformal word identity. So as any correlation function with this contour integral dz tz inserted with a bunch of primary field can be written as a bunch of partial derivative acting on the correlation function of the primary field. So what happens here is you do the OPE and you just drag this thing out. Okay, but then remember, how do we define our children operator? The children operator is defined to be the expansion, or let's say the mode of that, the mode of T phi. So all, on the other hand, I can write as L minus N acting on phi, this thing. Remember, we can always rewrite it as a contour integral of tz phi times z minus w to the power n minus 1. So it's the same trick. If you have a mode expansion, you can always use a contour integral to get it back. But this says all, any descendant is almost precisely this kind of thing. Then you can imagine that if there is a z minus w somewhere, it's probably still going to work. So basically, this, the miracle tells us if you have one children, the rest are all some primary field, then the correlation function is given by the partial differential operator acting on all primary field. And by induction, so anything correlation function is always some partial derivative acting the primary field. So that works, that sort of showed that it works for one descendant. And you can just use the inductions as you can gradually replace those all by descendants. And this is the miracle number one, says any correlation function can in principle be expressed as the partial derivative acting on primary field correlation function. So the only thing we care is about the correlation functions of the primary field. If we can calculate all of them, we're done. Yes.
That sum with the partial derivative.
Yeah.
You have z, but we're integrating over z, so is there a missing integral?
That's a very good point. Where did the z go?
From the middle board.
Mm-hmm.
You rewrite out the h and the partial operator.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no integral. Seems to be.
That should be. Good point. Why do I have this? But if there's no integral, then I can't use my cute argument of deforming contours. So there must exist this integral somehow. Maybe that just means I haven't done the integral yet. That makes more sense?
In that case, I guess we also eliminate the second order pole. Assuming the correlation function is not singular at WJ.
Mm-hmm. Well, you probably want to calculate this and then acting the partial and then do the integral because this might still hidden. No, there wouldn't. There wouldn't because this only doesn't depend on it. Okay, let me try to figure this out. Yeah, this is a very good question. Where did the z go? It should go, but the why is it still there? I don't know. I'll figure out, hopefully, before the tutorial. Okay, so that closed the remark about the first half of the lecture. Well, I am going to 11 after all. Sorry. Then we can look at the unitarity bound and say what kind of series we'll study. Okay, some of you, maybe all of you have already heard about this trivia question because when I told you, I didn't imagine I can get this far in this class. And the question is, there is a guy called Terry, and there is a guy called Terry. And most, especially in PI, his physicist friend demand that he can only drink one cup of tea in his whole life. Why? Sorry, you have got it. The physicist's friends who demand that has belief in unitary tea. Okay, so unitarity, let's see what we remember this. So now we know how to build states. What are states? State involve a conformal factor, conform weight, just which primary field you start with, and some vector k, which is defined to be this k, is like k1 minus k1 minus k2 minus k. L, they can even be the same as long as they satisfy one smaller or equal to all this thing, and then acting on H. So this is just a notation. So that's what we say. If you start with a primary state of H, I can build all the descendant states this way. And then what we want to do is to do the inner product of some sort of the state and then do another kind of state. Notation. I don't want this one to confuse with the other one. So again, I'll invoke my smiling face notation. This should be an alphabet of like gongish. But anyway, so I'm just saying that if you build some state from some primary field, and you build some other state from other primary field, and if you do this inner product, and you, according to this guy, inner product, well, according to the state operator correspondence, the inner product of the states is equivalent to the correlation function of some operators. So this should require that this two conformal weight to be equal. And we should also require that the sum of this k's equals to the other sum of the k's. That it would make us believe that at least they have the same energy. Otherwise, states from different energies should be orthogonal. And we also demand that if we calculate some norm, some state, if we calculate the norm, this should be bigger or equals to zero. So, as promised, let's look at the level one. And level one is particularly nice to look at it because there is only one state. It's this guy. I want to look at the norm of this guy. Okay? And this one is equals to H. Hermitian conjugate is like changing minus one to one, minus one, H. And now we can use our established method of doing this by rewriting it as commutators and this guy gets annihilated for many reasons and this one gave me two L0. And the L0 give you the eigenvalue, which is H. And this is already a norm, so that should be normalized to be positive. And if we require this to have a non-negative arm, it tells us all this conformal weight we talk about, they should be non-negative. So this is what the unitarity at the level one put a constraint on our conformal field theories, says that the conformal weight should be non-negative. Level one, we already get such good results. Think about our CFT space characterized by C and H, now we kill half of it. Not necessarily a good thing, but it happened. Okay, and this board is not particularly enlightening. Let's erase it. Huh? Any question?
The reason.
Yep, the reason.
The reason you need to use that C on 12 term is because
the C? Squared minus one. Yeah. Ah, very good. So let's move to the case that n squared minus one is not zero. Yeah, that's exactly where we're going, right? Now we consider the special state. Let's upgrade our consideration to L minus N acting on H. Well, N is bigger than 1. So that state is another state. So you still demand that the norm is non-negative. And let's see. It's the same thing. This is defined to be H ln L minus N H because look, if we don't define our Hermitian conjugate as we are, there's no way I can remember what this equals to. Okay, now we have to use the commutator again. And the other guy I'm lazy to write it down. It's going to be killed. Okay, now we have to write down the commutator, which is 2n L0 plus C over 12, because now we satisfy the delta n plus m equals 0, n times n squared minus 1. Ah, the C comes into play this time. And then the first term gave me 2n h. The next term is a constant. So I have this thing times the norm of primary field. Okay, let's choose a particular nice state, primary state to study. Why don't we choose h equals 0, which corresponding to the identity? Remember, we just did the t identity op. There's nothing irregular there. So this is corresponding to the identity. And in string theory, there is a nice tutorial, at least I feel it nice, tells that the identity operator actually acting on vacuum give you vacuum, which is what it's supposed to be. But there is a path integral way of to prove the state operator correspondence like very rigorously, that supposed to be you do the path integral of identity, and then you really get the vacuum. But anyway, let's choose h equals 0. Then this gives me, because n now is bigger than 1, this is bigger than 0. This tells me not only h has to be non-negative, c also have to be non-negative. Okay? Which means this is our plane of CFT series. And there's AC, and there's H over here. Now we just says they are all killed. If you want the unitarity, you can only focus on this part. Okay? Let's do level 2. And remember, after level 2, we just sort of referred interested readers to read about how people did the level 3 into infinity. But level 2 is not too bad. Okay. Level 2, now we have two grandchildren. One is L minus 1 acting twice. One is L minus 2 acting once. So then I decide to build a matrix. The matrix is built by, I'll just write this as the Hermitian conjugate. So I can definitely build a inner product matrix as such. So this is like inner product of this two, inner product of the cross term, and then inner product of those two. And the unitarity basically says your determinant of this matrix should be greater or equal to 0. So we can like diagonalize it to such that it's similar to those kind of requirements. You want to diagonalize it, get rid of the off-diagonal component, then you demand the inner product is bigger than 0. So this is slightly probably weaker bound than demand them individual. But this will give us very illuminating result on that plane. So far, we just basically take that plane, drop half, drop another half. And this will give us something more interesting. So let's see which one. Oh, but the one of them we already done. So this guy, this one we already done. I can just refer to this because it's a special one. It's the 2n guess 4H plus C over 12 times 2 times 3. So this is 4H plus C over 2. Is that right? No. Why? There's another factor of 2 somewhere. That's weird. And I think, there's a convention difference between the C. Well, if C is as what we defined, if this is defined to be C, then this has to be the case. But then you can do the other guys, which let's not do it since I apparently don't know how to do it on board. But you can check the note. I did put it in the appendix, as I always do, hiding this calculations in an appendix. But the result is this matrix looks like this. And you can see all this H just comes out by doing a bunch of commutators, and L0 will pop out and give you H, all the rest should be drop off, and such and such. And there is this discrepancy over here. I should check. But anyway, what we want to demand is the determinant of this is bigger or equals to 0. And if without doing too much calculation, you should realize the determinant of M is a degree 3 polynomial in H. So you can factorize it, and it also definitely includes a factor of h, so it has h times h minus h1, h minus h2, something like that. Right? If you cross, you just multiply this by minus this, you're definitely able to factorize a h, and whatever other things, you can throw them in this guys. It's a quadratic equation. And the A2 should be proportional to. And then we're going to demand this to be bigger or equal to 0. I mean, there is H1 and H2, but they don't really look very illuminating either. So I'll just not write them down. You can look at the notes. But the idea is, so this H1, H2 will be a function of C. Right? But the point is, if I demand this all, you can just say Mathematica. Mathematica, plot this contour plot on me, for me in H and C plane. Right? That gave me a contour plot. If I demand this determinant is bigger than 0, it will produce a contour plot on the H C plane, which I plotted. It's somewhat, so C equals 1 is somewhere here. And it go up to sort of 5/8, and then it looks something like this. And the Mathematica says, oh, this is all gone. The things inside of this contour is not a unitary. This is what level 2 tells us. H goes to 0. You have to check the plot. Okay, actually I have the plot here. Yeah. Yeah, there was actually a Mathematica code that did exactly that. It says, Mathematica, plot that thing for me. And then you find some constraints like this. And then, of course, you can do more level 3, 4, 5, infinity, who knows what happens, right? Because I didn't do it. But you do it, maybe more things get chopped off. You have all these constraints, just keep drawing contours on this. So is it a good thing? Well, I don't know. What if you have infinite constraints? And you might end up with nothing. And fortunately, it's not the case. You somehow end up with something. And these some things are called the unitarity minimum models, which I don't find those numbers very enlightening. So it's somewhere here. So it says that the central charge has to be something like this for some integer m. And then the allowed conformal weight is given by some crazy formula. And then it's interesting. So all this constraint, not only it didn't kill the entire parameter space, that's the first thing it doesn't do, which makes us happy. And the other thing makes us happy, it leaves us a discrete amount of, like you can't have like fixed central charge and H can be anything. It's actually discrete. It tells you exactly what kind of primary field you have, which is very interesting.
Are these the only ones?
These are the unitary models.
Okay, you can, the only unitary person.
Yeah, because that's the unitary just, but then you can also have, if you remove the unitary, and then you can also have the minimal models. But these are the models they find that have finite number of primary fields, which means we basically, in principle, solved the theory. And if you don't, you remove the unitarity constraint, instead of m plus 1, you just replace it by pq. But you say if you replace by pq, then c is not a necessary unitary. And they changed the somewhere else as well. But there is the minimum. There's minimum model without having unitary in front. But there is a particular interesting case. Is when m equals 3, it corresponding to the established 2D Ising model, which is almost solved immediately after it's written down. And with the 3D Ising model, we only have experimental results. But if you read Pedro's last year's lecture notes, he will tell you it's like 2014 or 13, like really, really recent. They managed to use high dimension, because d equals 3, unitarity constraints to manage to, like it's like the same thing. You have a plane, just keep chopping, putting unitary constraint, and they constrain to such a teeny, teeny, teeny island, and that give you the exponent, like the critical exponent, agree with the experiment. It's beautiful. But you have to read his lecture notes about it. And then you can read last year Freddy's lecture notes to continue to study 2D Ising model and realize, indeed, if you have a conformal field theory, who needs the lambda Lifshitz action? You just keep doing your correlation function and stuff. You can still predict your exponent to just because it constrains you so much, you know the primary field conformal weight, that gives you the correlation function with that. So, good. I didn't go over time after all. So, thank you. This would be the end of the class.